This is the Tax Update Podcast for May the 11th, 2009. This week, the limits on taking a return position. The Tax Update Podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research and confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the supporting document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use include using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. This week, we're going to take a look at the case of United States versus CAP, 2009 TNT 8430, a case decided by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that gives us a look at the application of the return standard positions under the law. The case involves whether a position taken by a CPA on numerous tax returns had a realistic possibility of success under the older rules of Section 6694. While that level of support is lower than would currently be required to take a return position without disclosure, the court's analysis is useful as the court concludes his position did not meet even that less strenuous standard. The IRS in this case had received an injunction against the CPA at the district court level, and the CPA in question appealed the ruling to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. While we all hope never to be subject to this sort of IRS action, the underlying analysis is the same one we should be using to analyze whether our positions are supportable under Section 6694 and the penalty provisions there. And this case includes some examples of what does not count. The case today is actually raised under a provision that grants the government the right to obtain an injunction against a tax preparer that stops a preparer from taking certain actions, including taking certain tax returns positions. That provision, found at IRC Section 7407, reads essentially as follows. It tells us under 7407A that there is an authority to seek injunction and holds that a civil action in the name of the United States to enjoin any person who is a tax return preparer from further engaging in any conduct described in subsection B or from further acting as a tax return preparer may be commenced at the request of the Secretary. Any action under this section shall be brought in the District Court of the United States for the district in which the tax preparer resides or has his principal place of business, or in which the taxpayer with respect to whose tax return the action is brought resides. The court may exercise its jurisdiction over such action as provided by 7402A, separate and apart from any other action brought by the United States against such taxpayer, preparer, or any taxpayer. Section 7407B that tells us in what conduct can cause this to go held for adjudication and decrees. In any action under subsection A that we just discussed, if the court finds the preparer has engaged in any conduct subject to penalty under Section 6694 or 6695 or subject to any criminal penalty provided by this title, B, misrepresents his eligibility to practice for the Internal Revenue Service or otherwise misrepresented his experience or education as a tax return preparer, C, guaranteed the payment of any tax refund or the allowance of any tax credit, or D, engaged in any other fraudulent or deceptive conduct which substantially interferes with the proper administration of internal revenue laws, and secondly, that injunctive relief is appropriate to prevent recurrence of such conduct, the court may enjoin such person from further engaging in such conduct. If the court finds that a tax return preparer has continually or repeatedly engaged in any conduct described in subparagraphs A through D of this section, the four items we mentioned earlier, and that an injunction prohibiting such conduct would not be sufficient to prevent such person's interference with the proper administration of this title, the court may enjoin such a person from acting as a tax return preparer, essentially a death penalty. Now, of special interest is Section 704B1's reference to actions subject to penalty under Section 6694. That particular provision has gotten a significant amount of attention in the past year or so due to changes that Congress twice made to that provision. But those changes did not change the fact that that provision continues to be referenced in this section of the IRC. though when Congress made those changes, it did expand this particular provision of 7407 beyond income tax return preparers and income tax returns to cover all returns and all return preparers, just as Section 6694 itself was expanded. And as the second section notes, there are two things the IRS must show to obtain injunctive relief. First, that the preparer had engaged in one of the four enumerated types of bad conduct, and second, that an injunction is needed to prevent a recurrence of this bad conduct. If those hurdles are met, an injunction can be issued prohibiting the preparer from engaging in the specific conduct. If the IRS seeks to prevent the person from acting at all as a preparer, there is another higher standard. The court must find the preparer continually or repeatedly engaged in such conduct, and that merely prohibiting the conduct would not by itself be sufficient to prevent the person's interference with the proper administration of the Internal Revenue Code. In the case we're looking at today, the district court did not impose the second death penalty provision, but rather imposed a more limited provision. In this case, prohibiting the CPA from preparing any tax returns containing a specific position he had advocated, but which the tax court had not ended up agreeing with. The case involves, of all things, the deduction available for meals and incidental expenses under Revenue Procedure 96C and its successors, as provided for by IRC Section 274D and implemented under Regulation 1.1274-5J1. The case involves two types of seafaring employees. Those of mariners who work on ocean-going ships that are away from port for long periods of time, referred to in the opinion as deep-sea mariners, and those who work on tugboats and barges that are not away from port for such extended periods. They're referred to in the opinion as tug and barge mariners. Martin Kapp was a CPA that prepared income tax returns, specializing in preparing returns for various individuals in the transportation industry, and specifically individuals in the two classes that we just discussed above. The initial matter of interest involved deep-sea mariners, specifically two of Mr. Kapp's clients. The Ninth Circuit opinion notes, between approximately January 1997 and February 2006, Kapp prepared tax returns for mariners who lived on vessels in the course of their employment that claimed the mariner's tax deduction, what he called their right to claim the deduction we'll talk about. Two of these returns were for Marin Johnson and Jim Westling, who were employed as deep-sea mariners during the tax year in question. Both individuals were provided meals at no cost but claimed a deduction based on the number of days at sea multiplied by the full meals and incidental rate. Mr. Kapp apparently decided that since the IRS's revenue procedure in this area didn't require that they had to substantiate the meals, it was okay if they actually never could have incurred any expenses whatsoever, but you could just show they were away from home and claim the deduction. The IRS did not agree, and Mr. Martin and Mr. Westling found themselves under examination and eventually in the tax court itself. The panel goes on to note, the Internal Revenue Service disallowed the deductions and Johnson and Westling filed petitions in the tax court. In 2000, the tax court held that although the mariners could deduct travel expenses while working away from home, Johnson and Westling could not deduct the full meals and incidental rate because they had not actually incurred meals expenses. Johnson versus Commissioner 115 TC 210 and Westling versus Commissioner, which was a tax court memorandum decision from the same year. They were permitted to deduct the incidental expense portion of their meals and incidental expense rate, however, because the mariners paid for items including personal hygiene supplies and bottled water at the ship's store. After these rulings, the IRS modified its revenue procedures and issued two chief counsel advisories, which concluded that taxpayers may not claim the full meals and incidental expense rate when only the incidental expenses are incurred. And the court notes to see Revenue Procedure 2002-63. Note the case wasn't a complete win for either party. The tax court decided that a deduction for meals didn't make sense in this case, but there should be some allowance for incidentals. As noted, the IRS adjusted their position to conform with the results of this decision. However, Mr. Kapp attempted to read this holding in this case in a very narrow sense, and he went public with his position as the opinion continues. After the Johnson and Westling's decisions, Kapp wrote several articles in a trade publication, The Professional Mariner, discussing potential tax deductions available to mariners. Kapp theorized that the different deductions available to deep-sea mariners and acknowledged that claiming additional meals deduction when meals are provided is considered double-dipping. He asserted that tug and barge mariners were entitled to claim the full M&IE deduction, reduced by the amount of their grocery allowance. Although he temporarily stopped claiming deductions on behalf of the deep-sea mariners, he continued to file returns claiming the deduction on behalf of his tug and barge mariner clients. As we'll discover later, that temporary cessation of taking this position for deep-sea mariners was reversed for less than stellar reasons by Mr. Kapp. But he decided there existed no limits on tug and barge mariners, because the taxpayer in Johnson was a deep-sea mariner. Mr. Kapp seemed to believe that that distinction was somehow very important, and that would have changed the holding of the tax court, even though these individuals, like the deep-sea mariners, did not actually incur meals expense during their time away from home. The IRS took note of Mr. Kapp's activity, and an investigation into Mr. Kapp was begun, which Mr. Kapp was notified of in November of 2003. The court details the initial results as follows. In November of 2003, the IRS notified Kapp that he was under investigation for conducting a tax shelter promotion. Attorney Dennis Perez represented Kapp. Perez and Kapp met with George Campos, the IRS agent in charge of the investigation, several times in 2004 and 2005. In a March 2005 meeting, the IRS informed Kapp that the mariner's tax deduction was not allowed under the Internal Revenue Code. A memorandum dated April 18, 2005, drafted by an attorney in Perez's firm, concluded that little authority supported Kapp's position that either deep-sea mariners or tug and barge mariners were entitled to deduct the full M&IE amount, because both types of mariners typically are provided meals by their employer at no cost. Mr. Kapp's attorney attempted to assure the IRS that the practice would be stopped by Mr. Kapp following this exchange. But the IRS didn't take the assurance at face value and continued to move forward. On May 5, 2005, Perez wrote a letter to Campos detailing Kapp's positions on deduction for tug and barge mariners. He followed with a second letter on July 27, 2005, which stated that although Mr. Kapp does not necessarily agree with the position you articulated for the first time in our meeting last month, he has agreed to cease claiming meal deductions as he has done previously. Campos did not respond to the letters. After completing the investigation, Campos prepared a final report concluding Mr. Kapp is instrumental in preparing erroneous income tax returns and incorrectly interpreting the Internal Revenue Code. The government filed a complaint in April 2006 seeking an injunction that would keep Kapp from claiming deductions for meals that are provided to an employee without cost. Well, it turns out that during depositions, Mr. Kapp admitted that a few months after assurance was given, he began again claiming the deduction for deep-sea mariners, and his reasons were unique, if nothing else. The court notes, during the course of litigation, Kapp was deposed by the government. He stated that he did not routinely ask mariners whether they were provided meals free of charge by their employer before claiming a deduction on their behalf. Additionally, he acknowledged that while he stopped claiming the full M&IE deduction for deep-sea mariners after the Johnson decision, he began it again in late 2005 or early 2006 based on a purported endorsement of his position by Campos and because he needed to be more aggressive in claiming deductions to provide negotiating room with the IRS. Well, there are a number of potential issues with his method there, not the least of which is that he never inquired about the fact that appeared to be crucial. Were you paid? In essence, did you actually have to pay for any meals, regardless of whether you have the record of doing so or are they provided for you free of cost? He also wanted to do it because he needed to be, quote-unquote, more aggressive in his positions with the IRS. So it appeared to be taking a position primarily so he'd have something to give up in an examination, apparently in hopes that the agent would then feel compelled to give up something else on his side in the course of the examination. Both parties argued at district court that they should obtain summary judgments for the following reasons, the court goes on to note. Both parties moved for summary judgment in February 2007. Kapp asserted he was entitled to summary judgment because his position regarding the deemed substantiation deduction for mariners was legally correct and was taken in good faith. By the way, those two points are both going to be issues for 6694. If your position is legally correct, you're fine. Or you have a good faith exception. So he's arguing those two exceptions to 6694. The government argued that an injunction was proper because Cap continued to claim the Mariner's tax deduction, even though he knew the deduction was improper. Obviously, the IRS is going to concentrate on that last adjustment where he needed to be, quote, more aggressive. Apparently, taking that as a concession that he knew the position was wrong, but, you know, he needed something to give up on exam. The district court sided with the IRS. In August 2007, the district court granted summary judgment for the government and permanently enjoined Camp for preparing tax returns to claim a deduction for meals that are provided to mariners without cost. The injunction also required that Cap provide a list of clients for whom he prepared returns claiming these deductions, post a link to the court's order on his website, and explain to his clients that the court's determination he had incorrectly advised them about the mariner's tax deduction. So Mr. Cap not only was ordered not to do this anymore, but would you please turn us over a list of the clients on whom you claim such a deduction? Would you also make sure on your website you post information indicating to the court a decision that a court has ruled you basically fouled up in how you handled these returns? And also contact your clients just in case they don't notice under the first two items and tell them that you basically fouled up their returns. As well, following that issuance of that injunction, the tax court did finally deal with a case involving tug and barge mariners. And it turns out the tax court did not agree that the difference was significant. The Ninth Circuit goes on. Subsequent to the judgment enjoining Camp, the tax court published two cases specifically addressing Camp's position regarding tug and barge mariners. See Zibilet v. Commissioner and Bala v. Commissioner. Relying on the Johnson decision, both cases held that tug and barge mariners could not use the regulations that permit deemed substantiation deduction for meals when no expense was incurred by the taxpayer. So now we discover for sure that to the tax court, the deep sea versus tug and barge difference wasn't a meaningful distinction when we're dealing with the issue of a deduction for M&IE per diem for a taxpayer that incurred no meal expense whatsoever. Given the fact Mr. Cap not only was barred from taking such a position on return, but also had to turn over the client list, confess the error of his positions to his clients, and post the court decision on his website, he clearly wasn't terribly happy with the result of this case. So he decided to appeal the holding to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The court outlines the basic M&IE law to support the discussion. Since the key question is whether Mr. Cap's position had sufficient support under the law to allow him to take positions on the return without disclosure. Note that while the court doesn't specifically say these positions were taken without disclosure, the standard used is the one that would have been applicable under Section 6694 at the time for positions taken without disclosure. Had disclosure been made, the test would have been whether his position was or was not frivolous. Today, remember, the test is whether or not your non-disclosed position had substantial authority, or whether for a disclosed position there was a reasonable basis for your position. The court goes on and notes that the commissioner issued revenue procedures which specify the Federal Travel Regulation M&IE rate as the amount taxpayer may deduct in lieu of substantiating actual costs of meals. The commissioner updates these revenue procedures annually, but the relevant provisions have remained substantially the same since 2000. Travel expenses below the threshold M&IE amounts are deemed substantiated, and the taxpayer is not required to provide documentation in order to deduct the expense. Additionally, the federal travel regulations provide that M&IE rate must be adjusted for a meal furnished to the taxpayer by deducting an appropriate amount. However, it goes on to note, in those regulations, which, by the way, are not Internal Revenue Code regulations, but are regulations of another entity, the GSA, a meal provided by a common carrier or complimentary meal provided by a hotel motel does not affect your per diem. Ships are included generally within the definition of a common carrier under these regulations. Mr. Camp was obviously attempting to use a common carrier exception, which was written in the federal travel regulations to cover individuals using basically obtaining those meals as customers of the carriers, to also yank in employees of a common carrier who are being provided with free meals, even though those individuals were not simply obtaining transportation, but rather basically were doing their main job. As noted, the tax court came to the conclusion that the exception for the complimentary breakfast at a Hampton Inn didn't quite stretch far enough to cover employees of the ship. But Mr. Capp's reading of the time the IRS went for a deduction so far from plausible to find that a Section 6694 penalty would not have been available, thus also stating that there would be no injunction provided. The Ninth Circuit, in beginning to describe the law, seems to me at least to get a little confused by the various applicable tests due to the change in the law, equating realistic possibility, reasonable basis, and substantial authority at times in its references. And unfortunately, it's pretty easy to reference to basically trip over these differences in the rules. But in the end, it appears clear the Ninth Circuit was applying the correct at the time the case was decided, I should say at the time that these actions took place, 1 in 3 test to its position, which would have been the case for a realistic possibility of success on the merits of the position. So the court was going after and going for that particular background. Now, it notes that what conduct is subject to penalty is defined in the regulations, and it provides it as a reasonable basis for a position if a reasonable and well-informed analysis by a person knowledgeable in the tax law would lead such a person to conclude that the position has approximately 1 in 3 or greater likelihood of being sustained. The court then goes on to describe substantial authority, objective, etc., and does seem to equate them all. But nevertheless, when we actually look at the opinion, it's going to apply that realistic possibility 1 in 3 test to this particular transaction, which, as I note, is a lower standard than we would have to meet today for an undisclosed position. The court points out that the district court properly enjoined Cap if he prepared to return under state liability due to an unreasonable position. That is, a position that objectively had a 1 in 3 chance, less than 1 in 3 chance of being sustained on its merit, and an injunction is appropriate to meet recurrence. So basically, it had to show the court's decision met all 3 tests. There was an understated liability, the position is unreasonable under the standards applicable to Section 6694 at the time, and an injunction is needed to keep Mr. Capp from doing this again. So did the position meet the 1 in 3 standard? The argument in question is summarized by the court for Mr. Capp goes as follows, that he argues that mariners do not have to pay or incur meals expenses in order to claim a deduction under the regulation that allows certain expenses to be deemed substantiated without documentation. Mr. Capp notes that meals provided by common carriers are not required to be subtracted from the allowed per diem deduction amount and that ships are included within the definition of common carriers. Therefore, he reasons, the mariners who are provided meals while on board a ship should be allowed to claim the full meals and incidental expense allowance for the days at sea, even though no meal expense is incurred. Cap also creates several complicated hypothetical examples to support an argument that under Section 274 regulations, certain travelers could claim a deduction for deemed substantiated expenses when no actual costs are incurred. However, the Ninth Circuit panel holds that the failure to actually pay any expenses is fatal to any deduction under Section 162 and lectures Mr. Capp on the distinction between code and regulations. It notes, Capp's argument is based on a misunderstanding of the regulations that create the deemed substantiated exception. He essentially argues that executive branch agency regulations can be manipulated to subvert provisions of the IRC enacted by Congress. The regulations are intended to interpret and assist in the enforcing IRC, not to undermine it. The IRC gives the Secretary and Commissioner discretionary authority to issue regulations to ease burden on taxpayers who would otherwise have to meet this extensive substantiation requirement, Section 274, in order to claim deductions for business-related travel. The regulations, however, do not eliminate the requirement in Section 162 that the expense must be paid or incurred in order to be deducted. To put it more simply, while it may not have to be that amount of expense, we have to incur and pay an expense. The court then goes on to explain the proper application of the regulations. The regulations reflect the requirements of Section 162. In the first section outlining their purpose, the regulations state that they provide an optional method for employees, self-employed individuals who pay or incur meal costs to use in computing the deductible costs of meals and incidental expenses paid or incurred while traveling away from home. After the Johnson decision, the regulations were altered to provide a method for computing the applicable deduction for incidental expenses when no meal costs were paid, noting here Revenue Procedure 2000-263. Therefore, while a meal provided by a common carrier need not be deducted from the per diem meals and incidental rate under 41 CFR section 301-11.17. The taxpayer cannot take the per diem deduction if he doesn't incur any meal-related expenses. And that's citing the revenue ruling that said it was intended for those that had incurred expenses. Additionally, CAP's examples of individuals who may attempt to manipulate the regulations to claim impermissible deductions when they do not incur expenses does not alter the requirement in Section 162 that expenses must be paid or incurred in order to be deducted. Because CAP claimed deduction on behalf of mariners who did not pay or incur meal expenses, he prepared returns that understated liability, triggering the first part of the test here, did they understate liability? But remember, being merely wrong in the end isn't enough. If his position had a realistic possibility of success or he acted reasonably, he would still not be subject to penalty under 6694 and by extension the application of an injunction under Section 7407. To deal with these issues, they note there are two positions in play here the Ninth Circuit does and consider separately his position with regard to both deep-sea mariners and tug and barge mariners. For deep-sea mariners, the court makes a quick work of this position, noting that CAP's own article conceded the position following the Johnson decision. CAP's assertion that deep-sea mariners were permitted to take the mariners' tax deduction is patently unreasonable in light of the ruling in the Johnson case. In that case, which arose from conduct nearly identical to the conduct that is the basis of this injunction, the court stated, we do not read the revenue procedures to allow a taxpayer to use the full meals and incidental expense rates when he or she incurs only incidental expenses. CAP unsuccessfully attempts to distinguish Johnson, but the clear implication of the holding is that taxpayers may not deduct meal expenses when no expenses are concerned. CAP acknowledged as much himself in his The Professional Mariner articles. But Mr. CAP claims that Mr. Campos, remember him, the IRS agent in charge of the investigation of Mr. CAP, had given him the green light to resume claiming this deduction. He argues that he claims he had recently resumed the practice taking deduction on behalf of deep-sea mariners based on the alleged approval of the position by Campos. In his declaration submitted in opposition to the government's summary judgment motion, CAP stated that I had a long meeting with IRS agent George Campos on August 12, 2005, during which I reviewed my legal position with him in detail. At the end of the meeting, Mr. Campos sort of threw his arm around me and stated, now I understand. Since Mr. Campos at no time during or after the meeting stated he disagreed with my position or that my position was frivolous, I interpreted Mr. Campos' statement as an endorsement of my legal position. Apparently, what might have been simple politeness on the part of Mr. Campos and a decision to reserve final judgment on the matters till he had time to review all materials was claimed by Mr. CAP to clearly indicate, at least to him, that it was okay to resume taking the position even in light of the Johnson holding. However, Section 6694 and the regulation referred to in interpreting it do not look to an IRS's investigating agent statement. In any event, the court didn't find the events, even if taken as literally true exactly as he described them, amounted to a green light to go ahead. The court notes, even accepting the accuracy of CAP's description of his interaction with Campos, the conduct is not an affirmation of CAP's position, allowing him to claim the deduction on behalf of deep-sea mariners, especially in light of the Johnson ruling. Because a well-informed analysis of the issue by a person knowledgeable in tax law would not lead to the conclusion that CAP's position had at least a 1 in 3 chance of being sustained on its merits, the position was unreasonable and not based on substantial authority. Thus, the court concluded his position with regard to deep-sea mariners was clearly not justified. However, what about the other claim that he should be able to take the position on tug and barge mariners, since the Johnson case didn't deal with tug and barge mariners, rather it dealt with deep-sea mariners? The court goes on to look at his justification there, and this helps us decide as to how we should distinguish cases or what is proper distinguishing facts in a case versus what's not. The court, to put it quickly, get the answer here, did not find the Johnson case truly could be distinguished for those who were tug and barge mariners. The mere fact that the case didn't involve that type of mariner specifically is not relevant if, in fact, the actual decision arrived at by the court is based upon factors that are the same for both the taxpayer in Johnson and the tug and barge mariners. As the court holds, CAP argues that claiming the mariner's tax deduction for tug and barge mariners was reasonable because Johnson applied only to deep-sea mariners. He contends that taking the deduction on behalf of tug and barge mariners who return to port more frequently presented novel issues. Although the Johnson case arose from a slightly different factual situation, the principles of the tax court holding clearly extend to tug and barge mariners. The essence of the court's holding is that individuals may not deduct the full meals and incidental expense rate when they do not incur meal expenses. By extension, if tug and barge mariners do not incur meal expenses, they may not take a deduction. The frequency of a mariner's return to port is irrelevant to the holding of the case. The court's view, as it will mention a number of times, is that the Johnson case is decided applies to any employees who simply do not incur any actual meal expenses. Other differences between Johnson and Mr. Capp's clients simply aren't relevant in the analysis. The memorandum prepared by Mr. Capp's attorney's other attorney on staff also came to evidence, was also cited by the court. Now, we should note the court made mention that this arguably might have been covered by client attorney privilege, but Mr. Capp's attorney brought it forward during discovery, so it was now available for discussion. The court notes that a memorandum prepared by an associate of Capp's lawyer, Perez, concluded there was little support for Capp's position that tug and barge mariners could deduct meal expenses when no cost was incurred. Although Capp claims he asked Perez to play devil's advocate and draft a memorandum that laid out the arguments in opposition to his position, the memorandum itself presents an even-handed explanation of the issues and states that little, if any, authority relied upon by Mr. Capp supports the position he takes. After thoroughly analyzing a host of tax court cases and IRS publication, the memorandum concludes that although the analysis does not foreclose the possibility Mr. Capp could ultimately be successful in the issue, it appears to me that the weight of authority favors the government on this issue. Shortly after the date of this memorandum, Perez wrote the letter to Campos stating that although Capp did not agree with the position taken by the IRS, he agreed to stop claiming the deduction. So it appears that his attorney, after receiving that from the other attorney in his office, had told Mr. Capp that, you know, we're going to have to concede here and just agree not to do this anymore. The finding of little or no authority by a person that he specifically hired to take a critical look at his position was not a good development for Capp, especially since it appears that he continued to take that position even after being made aware of the results of this analysis. Presumably, we'll say, having staked out his position very publicly, it would have been rather awkward for Mr. Capp to have reversed course at this point. So it appears he decided not to do so. As well, we might speculate the fact that Mr. Campos never came back and responded, you know, may have indicated to him, well, we just got to play rough. Remember, he liked to be aggressive, as he said, with the IRS, so this was his way of getting aggressive. The court also noted the tax court cases decided specifically on point after Mr. Capp had prepared these returns. They're significant not because Mr. Capp knew about them. Clearly, he could not have. They didn't exist at the time he did this. But rather because they back up the court's conclusion and Mr. Capp's own expert that Johnson rationale was going to apply to tug barge mariners and anybody else who didn't pay for meals. The court notes, additionally, in two rulings issued after the district court entered the injunction against Capp, the tax court rejected the contention that tugs and barge mariners were entitled to deduct the full meals and incidental allowance when no meal costs are incurred. While we cannot evaluate the reasonableness of Capp's position in light of these rulings issued after the IRS investigation, it is worth noting that the tax court stated that the issues presented were not novel. Remember, his position was they were novel. And the court relied heavily on the reasoning in Johnson to reach its conclusion. Thus, the panel concluded, although there was no precedent at the time Capp prepared the returns that specifically stated tug and barge mariners may not claim the mariner's tax deduction, a well-informed analysis by a person knowledgeable in tax law would have led to the conclusion that Capp's position had less than a 1 in 3 chance of being sustained on its merits. Therefore, his position was unreasonable and not supported by substantial authority. But what about the good faith defense? You know, I acted in good faith, and that's a defense against the application of 6694 penalty. And in this case, would have been against the issuance of the injunction. The panel considered that issue now, having decided that the position itself lacked the necessary level of support. And also having indicated that Mr. Capp's action indicated he would be likely to repeat the actions in the future. Something that honestly probably didn't help him when the court was looking at the question of whether he acted in good faith when he decided to start taking the position again after he'd been told by his attorney that the position was not reasonable. Mr. Kapp attempted to claim he made a good faith effort to seek comment on and support for his position. And this is of interest because some of the things he's going to discuss here are ones that some practitioners might believe should indicate that they are actually trying to get it or that they believe is justification for purposes of 6694. Now, let's not forget we have a bad facts case here, the fact that he had agreed to get more aggressive. So before you go too far off believing this would never justify good faith, just be aware that obviously staking out a position eventually because you want to be aggressive with the IRS probably isn't a good admission, especially after having been told the position's not going to stand up. But in any event, the court does pretty much analyze the fact and state, you know, you really weren't reasonable relying on these positions. What did Mr. Kapp do? Well, he claimed he consulted with attorneys in the IRS's national office for comment on his articles prior to publication. He also contacted a GSA official to confirm the common carrier exception. Finally, he claims to rely on the advice of two separate attorneys in the private sector for the position he was taking. The court found his reliance on IRS attorneys and GSA official would not be relevant even if the court accepted his testimony as a complete truth on the matter. The court notes, although Kapp made effort to seek comment on support for his positions, his efforts do not allow him to claim the good faith defense. Government employees contacted by Kapp do not qualify as preparers under the regulation, and he is not entitled to rely on their advice. This cites Treasury Regulation 301-7701-15. That defines a preparer as a person who prepares returns for compensation, and it specifically excludes IRS employees performing official duties. Even if other employees qualify as preparing the regulation, Kapp is not entitled to rely on their advice unless it can demonstrate they are aware of all relevant facts. That's also a key factor when you're going to claim reliance on someone else. The correspondence between the GSA employee and Kapp does not demonstrate that the GSA employee was aware that taxpayers in question did not pay or incur any meal expenses. Additionally, the IRS attorneys contacted by Kapp informed him that they could not officially comment on his articles, and there was no procedure set up a meeting to provide advice specific to his situation. So he may have omitted one not so minor detail when discussing the matter with GSA official, and the IRS attorney specifically defined comment. So much for reliance. The private sector attorneys would have had a better shot at qualifying as preparer and as well could have been relied upon and provided with all information. But Mr. Kapp didn't demonstrate either to be the case. The court notes, Kapp's also claims to rely on the advice of private sector's attorneys Stoller and Palmer, but he failed to show that either attorney qualifies as a preparer. Even assuming that they qualify, Kapp failed to demonstrate that either was aware of all relevant facts underlying the returns he filed claiming the mariner's deduction. The record shows he had general conversation with Palmer about the travel regulations in the Johnson case, and that Stoller reviewed and agreed with the professional mariner articles. General conversation about regulations and cases and review of an article, however, do not demonstrate that either Stoller or Palmer analyzed the relevant facts and advised Kapp his position was correct. Kapp's counsel during the investigation, the only attorneys who appeared to analyze position in light of all relevant facts, concluded he was not entitled to claim the deduction. Again, unfortunately, that memorandum comes back to haunt Mr. Kapp. Mr. Kapp's final defense is one that we tend to run into from time to time, and that some professionals seem to believe is golden, that the position had survived exams previously resulting in no change audits, and it has such he should be able to use such practical experience in no change audits to demonstrate good faith compliance. The court deals with this one very quickly, noting, finally, Kapp is not entitled to rely on no change determinations made in IRS audits. See IRC Section 6110K3. Therefore, Kapp is not entitled to assert a good faith defense for his violations of Section 6694, and the district court did not err in entering the injunction under Section 7407. But Mr. Kapp finally tried to argue that the injunction was overbroad in its application. He first tries to claim he's now prevented from claiming the deductions that other preparers can claim. The panel replies, the district court's injunction prevents Kapp from preparing returns claiming a tax deduction for meals that are provided to mariners at no cost. The tax court's decisions in Johnson, Bala, and Zibiat, however, prevent any tax preparer from claiming such a deduction. The injunction does not place Kapp at a unique disadvantage relative to other preparers. Of course, we should note that preparers who are competent who competently, properly, and legally prepare returns are blocked by those rulings, but those who don't share those particular attributes may have been claiming it anyway. As well, there may very well be preparers out there taking contrary positions, ironically perhaps by reference to the very article Mr. Kapp wrote. But because they're out there, that of course not going to deny the petition just so that Mr. Kapp can also violate the law because others are violating it. Kapp also claims it discriminates against his Mariner clients by preventing him from taking deductions that can be taken by other transportation industry clients. The panel, again, basically very, very, shall we say, patiently explains that, in fact, the Johnson decision would apply to any taxpayer that did not actually incur any meals expense. It notes, additionally, this injunction does not prevent Kapp from claiming deductions for Mariners that he is entitled to claim for other clients. Section 162 requires that all business expenses must be paid or incurred in order to be deducted. The commissioner has discretionary authority to issue regulations that alter the substantiation requirements under Section 274. It is possible that some of these regulations intended to ease the burdens on taxpayers create situations where an unscrupulous taxpayer may claim to deem substantiated deduction when no expense has actually occurred. The regulations do not, however, eliminate the requirement that the expense must be paid and incurred before it can be deducted. All taxpayers, regardless of occupation, must first pay or incur expenses before they are entitled to take a deduction under Section IRC 162. Mr. Kapp faced an issue that many of us end up facing at some point. We may take a position on a matter that's later determined to be erroneous when a court finally specifically rules on the point, and that court that finally rules may finally end up being the U.S. Supreme Court, so we now have the answer. He seems, though, to have responded by this by attempting to find any justification to distinguish the case that went against him from being applied to any other client of his. While it's important to analyze our fact patterns that present us to see if they present distinguishable characteristics from those in an unfavorable decision, we have to continue beyond merely saying, oh, I found a difference between this guy and that guy. We have to demonstrate reasonably why those differences are significant and could change the opinion. If we approach the issue from the standpoint of first deciding on the conclusions that we are going to get support for, then we tend to run into problems like Mr. Kapp did. If you know the answer you're going to get before you even start looking to find support for the answer, that tends to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. While we clearly would be aware of the answer to be more favorable to our client, when doing our analysis, we need to approach the analysis from initially unbiased perspective to determine objectively what true support exists for each position, and then make our judgment calls. We don't have to unerringly determine our example is right, meaning that we eventually prevail in court, but we do have to make our analysis with the proper level of detachment initially as we arrive at our judgment on the various positions available. And we have to be constantly aware of the bias that may be introduced simply from the standpoint that we may have staked out the position previously because new materials came to light, or because we are aware that other practitioners who may be less skilled or less scrupulous may be willing to file returns with the position in question, meaning that we're going to take it to try and preserve and not lose the client. In this case, it appears the preparer was not willing to consider evidence that supported the opposite conclusion from the one he wanted to arrive at. In the end, his approach to doing the research appears to have cost him ability that it was not unreasonable to take the position. Had he truly documented the weighing of both supporting and contrary rulings, as well as taking into account the conclusions of his own counsel's research that came to the contrary conclusion, he might not have faced the injunction and needed to confess to his clients, potential clients, and turn over the list of clients. This has been the tax update for May the 11th, 2009. The tax update, as always, is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Be sure to consider subscribing to their newsletters. As I've mentioned before, I am on Twitter, so if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's Ed Zollers. And I look forward to seeing some of you when I lecture in Phoenix on June the 5th. We deal with, in that case, a course on construction contracting. This has been the Tax Update.